Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to Down to Agribusiness with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hi folks, I'm Jack Kennedy and welcome once again to this week's Down to Agribusiness podcast. I'm joined once again by Phelim O'Neill to talk all things agribusiness, I suppose, Phelim, in terms of what has happened in the last week. We've both been travelling. I've been to far-flung London while you have been up north at the Balmoral Show, and you were up in as far as Donegal, I believe, in the last week. Where were you?
It's absolutely true, Jack. I've been getting around the place, and actually beat you on the air miles as well. As a matter of interest, I was in Brussels on Tuesday and out on the same day, and starting to realise maybe that I'm getting too old for such a programme. But there you go. It's good to be out again meeting people, and certainly that was the vibe from Balmoral. Everyone was just delighted to be there. Sun was shining. There was the odd couple of showers came in during the day, but even that didn't dampen the mood. You know, it was a very, very upbeat show. Prices are good. Recognition that cost inputs are going to be a problem, but nothing was going to spoil the day for the farmers that were in attendance on the first day of it anyway.
As long as prices stay up, it'll definitely help the situation, Phelim. Like, I mean, I was in London at the Dairy Industry Newsletter Conference, and again, it gives you a good snapshot of kind of, I suppose, what's happening around the world. And I have a piece in the journal this week on the whole supply dynamic piece there around dairy products and dairy milk supply, essentially, is really what it comes down to. And like, I mean, there's a big restriction. Like, I mean, it's the very same in the meat world, I'm sure, but there's a big restriction at the moment in terms of milk supply. And so you have the New Zealanders, obviously, at the different time of the year to us, like, you know what I mean, but their supply is down 3-4%, like we say, and our supply here in Ireland is down 3-4%, and in Europe it's down as well. And
if you think about the big producers like the Netherlands and Germany, the whole environmental question is coming on to everyone's agenda. And you look at and you put that against the background now, looking at the FAO 2030 forecast figures again, like the world is going to need 95 million tons more of dairy products by then. So production is getting more difficult. It feels like it's getting more constrained all the time. So it's inevitable. And that has to be good news from a price point of view.
It should be. Like, you would absolutely say so. Like, and like, it's I don't know. We're both in the industry a long time. But I haven't seen it like it is at the moment in the dairy industry, you know, in the 20 plus years that I've been in the sector, you know. And just in terms of the prices that are there currently at this time of the year for European producers, it's phenomenal. Like, now at the same time, there's businesses not making money. Like, I mean, over in England, like the liquid milk or the fresh milk business is a big part of the business. 50% of their milk in the UK goes into fresh milk or liquid milk for the supermarkets piece, you know. And we're completely different here in Ireland, obviously, where 90% of it goes into commodities, cheese, butter, powders, etc., and that kind of thing. But it just leads into another little piece that you have in terms of the unfair trading practices, because like the supermarkets and the retailers get an awful lot of stick, like we'll say, from the UK farmers about, you know, below cost selling of liquid milk and what happens there, and they can't make money from it and they're not going to supply it. And just coming back to the supply piece, like some of the speakers talked about a situation where retailers, where supermarkets were just not going to get volume, or just not going to get milk this year, or because the processors were saying, listen, no, can't do it at that price. We have X to do, and we can get X there, and we're not going to put it into fresh milk. So like that's a huge, like, you know, to have an empty shelf like is not good for a supermarket or a retailer.
That's a dilemma, Jack. Like, the reality is supermarkets in the UK in particular are desperate to control prices in as far as they can for their customers. And on the other hand, then commodities and international markets, and we've seen the price of butter and cheese, etc., over recent weeks and months, you know, it has been an onward increasing price. So, you know, the inevitability is, if liquid milk isn't working at a processing level, then they have to divert elsewhere.
They do. Very, very sure to do. And like, they're slow to do it because obviously they have relationships and trading pieces with these companies, like, you know, but I mean, the reality is they just have to move. So far, while I was over there, went into Sainsbury's and a couple of the stores just to see kind of the what's on the shelves, etc., and that kind of thing. And like, they have a long way to go to reach the commodity prices that are there, Phelim, on the dairy mm-hmm. side anyway, you know, on the cheeses and the butters and the liquid milks. It's a long way to go if already there's a squeeze on. So, I mean, you know,
it sounds to me there, Jack, that the UK dairy sector is a little bit caught in the same place as the Irish beef sector, maybe, because we have seen in recent weeks and months, and now for 6 months at this stage, farm gate beef prices surging on in Central Europe, you know, when countries that would always have lagged very far behind Irish prices are now actually significantly ahead of them. I'm thinking of Poland, I'm thinking of Germany, and thinking of the Netherlands. And, you know, Irish factories are long established business relationships with UK supermarkets, food service, restaurant sectors, the large burger chains, etc., and they're slow. They're struggling to get the money squeezed out of that market for the Irish product, and they're equally slow to walk away from them and maybe exploit international markets to the extent that they could. I suspect that'll happen over a period of time. And it sounds to me like there's a parallel there between the experience of the Irish meat industry and perhaps the UK dairy industry.
Yeah. Definitely. I think you're onto something there. There's definitely a piece there. Do you know this unfair trading practice piece that you have? Like, I mean, so this is, I call it the food ombudsman piece, like we'll say, where that has been called for years and years and years, with someone with teeth, with control, with power to be able to kind of, what way is it playing out in terms of what you have this week in the journal, Phelim?
Yeah, the food ombudsman that never was, Jack. Yes, it was earmarked in the program for government that it would be established, that the office would be established, but what we have finished up with is somewhat less than that. It's not a food ombudsman that we're getting, but it's an office for fairness and transparency, is what is grandly termed. Now, you might say, look, what's in a name? I suppose what's in a name from a farmer's perspective, everyone understands what an ombudsman is, you know, in terms of regulation in the major sectors where there's a one or two or a small number suppliers dominate a marketplace. But the fact then that we've went into the Office of Fairness and Transparency and we've now seen the detail behind it, the types of areas that they're covering, and I've went into it in some detail this week in Industry Insight, and what we're concluding is here, and I don't want to be completely dismissive of it, because where we had nothing before, we are now going to have something, and there will be people that it will benefit, and I suppose from a farming point of view, farmers that would have direct supply relationships with supermarkets, for example, through in the horticulture sector, then there will be an element of protection there in terms of payment terms, in terms of supermarkets not being able to unilaterally reject product and send it back to them, or cancel notices, cancel orders, etc. You know, those things will be guarded against. But for the vast majority of farmers that are trading in milk or cattle or sheep or pigs, etc., that have relationships with the major processing units, the issues that have been covered here aren't really the issues that have created difficulties or friction. You know, most farmers are satisfied with the time in which they're paid. You know, some Irish beef factories, for example, pay on the day. The co-op structures and the dairies processors have a payment schedule, and that's adhered to. And that's not the issue. The big debate always at a farmer level, certainly on the meat side, is, you know, it's prices and where the money's going, particularly in a weak market situation. And look, whilst transparency is in the title for the new office, I don't see anything in relation that's going to increase transparency from a farmer viewpoint after what happened, after the product leaves, after his cattle or sheep or whatever leaves the farm gate.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, just talking to some of the guys over in London again, I mean, and the UK piece, and again, trying to draw parallels with, I suppose, the government backing of agriculture in the UK versus Ireland. Some of them are very despondent, and it'll come out in a short interview I recorded there with Robert Craig. We'll hear it here now once we're finished talking, you know. But I mean, he was saying that the government over there, the lacking or the backing of agriculture lacks severely. Like they don't see it as a kind of a driver of you know, of jobs, of investment, etc. around the country. Like, I mean, would you have picked that up on your travels over there and your understanding of the piece over there?
It has always been the situation in the UK. And, you know, if you go back to when they were a member of the European Union, they were usually the most vociferous opponents to any cap deal that was being renegotiated or a farm budget being put in place. UK were always looking to cut that. And that was one of the surprising factors. Like, Brexit would have had quite a level of support in the UK farming community. You know, there's different numbers put on it, but certainly at least 40% of farmers would have thought it was a good idea. Whereas the reality of life is that anyone that ever sort of kept an eye on EU policy over the years, you know, Ireland and UK agreed in many things in Europe, but they certainly never agreed in terms of support for agriculture. UK governments were always distant from it. But Jack, you know, the comments he makes there, if you think of this from an Irish perspective in terms of agriculture's place in the priority for the Irish government, you do sense that it has diminished somewhat as time has progressed here. You know, we're now focused and we look at trade deals, we look at negotiations, and the reality is the Irish big government interest is it's very much in the multinationals that are using Ireland as a base, whether it's in pharma, whether it's in computers or whatever it might be, in technology. Yes. You know, so the agriculture lobby, and maybe there's a lesson for us here in the UK context, that the agriculture lobby has to work very hard at a government level to keep agriculture as a priority in Ireland and to have its place cemented as something that would be very easy to lose.
Yeah, I know, I'd agree. And kind of the everyday example of this is the data center versus the cow in terms of what's the problem here around the whole environmental space. Like, you know, and you go to any of the major cities around Ireland and you see these data centers or big industrial places, you know, taking shape, you know, and yet the cow and livestock is blamed for a lot of the environmental piece. Like, it does make you think, and it creates a kind of a them versus us piece, like, doesn't it, in terms of what's driving the economy here and what's real in terms of making the environmental piece better or worse. Like, yeah,
absolutely. And you know, other major countries like data centers, they're very energy hungry businesses. You know, other countries choose Ireland to outsource their energy requirements to, whereas if we restrict and constrain the natural indigenous industries that involve livestock in this country, that essentially means that we will outsource production to elsewhere in the world. And one of the things I covered this week here on the page was in our World News section, was just looking at, again, the month of April was another record clearance of Amazon rainforest in Brazil, and the area the size of the three smaller Irish counties, actually Carlow, Dublin and County Louth, an area greater than any one of those counties was cleared during the month of April. And that is where we have a big global debate, and why it's so inaccurate actually to try and tackle this whole question at a national level. It's a global problem that needs a global solution, and I think that's the ready-made evidence for it there in front of us.
And like, I mean, that all relates, of course, to the Mercosur trade deal and what's going on there, the agreement with the EU and these countries. And I mean, our commissioner at the time, Phil Hogan, like, of course, he was instrumental at the time in terms of that piece. But I mean, was it fair to say that, like, that agreement was built on the back of a kind of a ceasing of clearance over in some of those countries?
Not just a cessation of clearance, Jack. It was actually a major replanting project as well to offset the clearance that has been created in recent years. Now, look, that is now 3 years ago next month since that deal was concluded, and the whole clearance process has gathered pace in that time. Now, interestingly, look, there's been virtually no steps taken to ratify the Mercosur trade deal. Mercosur countries aren't that obsessed with it either, given the success that they've made in growing their business in China. So it's maybe not the top priority at the moment in, at either EU or Mercosur policy level. But I think that purely on the basis of what was agreed there alone, that deal would have to fall at this stage. And I would certainly expect, and remember now that approval of the parliament has to be secured as well. And given the very strong green influence that is in the current European Parliament, it's virtually impossible to see how that might get ratified at this stage. But look, something to be aware of in the background. It's not an issue that's maybe going to confront us today, tomorrow, or next week, but it's certainly one that hasn't gone away completely, and one that is as relevant now as it was 3 years ago. And this is something that we would have challenged the then commissioner on in an interview at the time, you know, about, you know, what guarantees or assurances we have in this space. And look, you know, we have to be prepared to hold the commission to account, even though there's been quite a change in personnel since then.
And there could well be a change of personnel in Brazil as well. Bolsonaro is up for election again. I think is this autumn coming?
That's right, October, Jack, the Brazilian elections, and he would be well behind his a previous occupant of the office at this stage in terms of opinion polls. But of course, as anyone will tell you, the only poll that really counts is the one on the day. He is quite a charismatic campaigner, and he does have a very dedicated following. And look, but there's no doubt COVID has done him considerable damage. And the thinking at the moment in Brazil is that he'll not get re-elected. But look, there's a long time to go between now and October, and plenty of time for a change in polls and people's attitude.
I mean, so I'm talking about on the AgBiz pages this week, I'm talking about the supply and demand dynamic in the milk side of things and the dairy side of things. Like, I mean, Adam and yourself are on the beef side of things. And I mean, Irish price continues to, continues to play catch up, Phelim. Is that the right way of kind of describing it?
For me, that's the correct term, Jack, because, you know, whilst it has been increasing progressively, really for a year now, the reality is it has been rising faster elsewhere. And we have now, and if you look at the comparisons again, the price has leveled off in the European Union, the countries that we would do most of our trade with, whereas the Irish price continues to rise. And I think if you look at the seasonal pattern for beef prices in Ireland, Jack, you find that in any year they tend to peak sometime around month of June, you know, either early June, later June. But usually from that on now, they tend to come under pressure as grass cattle become, the supply of those become available. But look, there's some thoughts this year that given the high rate of culling of cows that has taken place because of the sheer cost of fertilizer, that farmers are actually looking to maybe accepting that they will keep fewer stock with less grass, and that is that's meant bigger throughput. So there's a view that perhaps that maybe we're running slightly ahead of ourselves in terms of the cattle that we've killed this year, and we mightn't see the dip. But look, that'll become apparent over coming weeks. You know, the historical pattern is that they dip in the second half of the year. But as I said, this time round, we're now catching up. We still haven't caught up yet with most European markets. We're still well behind the UK. So, you know, in terms of headroom, the point that Adam made is that factories are actively chasing cattle because they're the mart price now. They're going out and spending huge money in March to try and keep their overall buying average down. So that's something that's worth watching, and one that we need to monitor on a week by week, if not indeed a day by day basis in terms of that trade.
Yeah, no, definitely. Look at Phelim, it's been good to chat again. I was lucky enough to get talking to the vice chairman of First Milk Cooperative over in London, and we might just play a couple of minutes off that little chat that we had just to tail off this podcast, because it's very interesting. I mean, First Milk were a cooperative that were in big trouble there not that long ago. I'll say 5 or 6 years ago, and they were down paying 14, 15, 16 pence a litre. So in June now, they've set their price for June. We're still setting April prices here in Ireland this week, but they're setting their price for June, and they have it up at 49, almost 50 cent a litre.
A different world, Jack,
compared to, but the business is, you know, Sheila Hancock came in as CEO, and she was speaking in London, and I got talking to the vice chairman. He's a dairy farmer, Robert Craig. So listen, I think it's interesting just to have a listen to it and some of the developments in First Milk, or maybe not developments. They're maybe holding their own some of the way as well, and trying to get more value without getting more milk, which is going to be the way across the world now, it looks like, for the next couple of years. They're trying to get more value out of the milk that they already have. Phelim, thanks for that. We'll chat again next week. And folks, have a listen to that short little clip with Robert Craig, Vice Chairman of First Milk.
Folks, delighted to be joined by Robert Craig. Robert, we've had a good couple of days here at the DIN conference in London. Look, at in general, I'll sum it up and say, like, the demand for dairy product is still good. Milk price is good at the moment. I see First Milk have put up their price for June at 42 pence a litre. It's the equivalent of about 49 cents a litre in euro terms. Like, I suppose, Robert, from what you've heard over the last couple of days and what you know with your dealings with First Milk, can the milk price settle at a new higher level, do you reckon?
Well, certainly an extraordinary place, Jack. And no one could have foreseen really where things have gone in the last 12 months. But, you know, I'd have been a little bit more pessimistic coming into the conference that maybe, you know, we were going to see at some point something was going to go wrong. We're going to see a big drop and we would get back to where we were. But I think if you look globally, you look at the supply constraints, you look at consumption rising. There's maybe a bit of a watch out for China. Quarter one of this year, you know, demand's dropping off, but we can almost explain that around the shipping and congestion around ports and COVID lockdowns in China and one thing and another. So, yeah, I'd be confident. You know, we're going to find a new base. Where it is, I'm not sure. You know, there's probably still movement in the market yet. We're going to probably see further price rises. It'll be really interesting to see what happens after peak. That's going to sort of lay the foundations out for what's going to happen in the rest of the milk year. Obviously, New Zealand are going to start a new season, so it depends how, you know, those farms in the southern hemisphere kick off. So we're going to see a rebasing of it, quite where that is, but it's considerably higher than it's been historically.
Robert, the First Milk story has been extraordinary, in fairness, to some extent, in terms of it's not that long ago where we saw milk prices of sub 20 pence a litre, and now you're close on, you know, 42 pence a litre. It's quite extraordinary. In terms of the story around the co-op, I suppose, and First Milk, where it has come from, where it is going, speaking and listening to your CEO, Sheila Hancock, she talks about 40 million invested over the last number of years. Will it continue to invest? Will First Milk continue to invest in processing capacity and maybe taking on new suppliers?
So, yeah, this has been an incredible journey. I mean, I've been on the board almost as long as Sheila's been with us, so a good sort of 5 years. We've invested heavily. We've refocused the business back on the sites, on operational efficiency, so extracting as much from the sites as we could, investing heavily in really updating those factories. I mean, we were recently around one of the sites last week at a board meeting, and it's practically a new site in an old wrapper, you know, and it's extraordinary where we've got the extra production from. There's more to be done. There's cheese vats to be upgraded and expanded, so there is more capacity to be released from those sites, so more investment. That's more difficult than it was, I think, because obviously all this cost in stainless steel has gone up considerably. So, you know, we're reevaluating them options now. But yeah, the growth, you know, growth is going to come in maybe other ways, other partnerships, focusing maybe on different ingredients and building more sort of partnership working across. But I don't think there's a great step change in First Milk coming. It's just gradual increasing our efficiencies, increasing our outputs, you know, delivering better returns and stability back to our members. That's the key direction.
Last question. One of the big differences, I suppose, between Ireland and the UK is the liquid element of it, or I call it the fresh milk element of it, that's over here. Like, over 50% of your milk is in that market, whereas in Ireland, of course, it's 10% and less, you know, and falling proportionately, of course, as the Ireland milk pool increases. You know, in terms of the liquid milk market over here, Robert, I mean, for me, it's still problematic. It's still in trouble. Albeit price is increasing at the retail level at the moment, but you know it still is a way to go to be competitive for the industry. Am I right in that assumption?
Yeah, you are, Jack. And that is the big question, Matt. What is going to happen to the liquid sector? I mean, it's just, if we continue to underproduce, you know, as a nation of milk, we're down considerably on last year. That's likely to continue. Somebody will be short of milk. And it's likely to be that sort of middle ground, smaller processor that's putting milk into the sort of smaller retail corner shop, garage forecourt type of thing. So, you know, if they don't pay, they don't get the milk. It's as simple as that. Milk for export, for manufacture, for processing into ingredients, that's where the value is. You know, we've got a reducing amount of milk being produced, an increasing demand, and that demand will be fulfilled. And it's likely to be overseas rather than domestic. So I don't see that happening somehow. I think at some point, they're going to have to stump up and pay. No supermarket, no shop, no corner shop wants to see the shelves without liquid milk. So, you know, you're going to see a revival in the value there, I would imagine, at some point.
I mean, is there any opportunity of a kind of a rebalancing in terms of those companies that were in the liquid piece might move into kind of, I'll call it a commodity game, whatever that is, butter, powders or cheese. Like, is there any of that going on?
I don't see it. I think we're short of processing. I don't think we've invested well enough in processing. So, I mean, just to see the amount of money that you guys have invested down in Ireland there, you know, there's a phenomenal amount of money that you've put in there that we would need to do to fulfill that. You know, we've got limited capacity here. Mm. So I guess that's going to max out at some point. It's supply and demand, depends how much milk we produce, of course. You know, we could come out of this huge spike in milk price with more production, but... it's going to be limited by capacity to process.
And I suppose that leads me on then, I mean, and last question now, Robert, I'll leave you go after this, but in our farmers, our first milk farmers willing to invest? Like, I mean, maybe not take, because I mean, you're lucky, you have a cooperative, I'll say, it's successful now. I mean, is it a possibility, is it an opportunity to try and maybe invest for the future now and try and not return the best price all the time, but with an eye to the future?
That's a really good question as well, Jack. But milk price is sanity, isn't it? Turnover is vanity. Do we need to do that as a co-op? You know, do we really? Is that where we want to be? We want to, you know, obviously reward our dairy farmers as well as we can. We're stable. We've got some fantastic, you know, partnerships across the industry. We're stable. It's a great opportunity because I see a lot of land in the UK that could produce dairy that is not producing dairy at the moment. So there is huge opportunity there. But you know, the industry would have to dig very deep into its pockets, and pockets that aren't that deep, I think, across. I'm really envious. When you look at the Irish story, you see how the industry aligned. You know, from research to processing to government to extension, all of that, you know, came alive, and you know, you had that massive ambition and vision, and you achieved it. We don't have that. We don't have the political engagement. We don't have the vision and leadership really across the industry, which we would need to fulfil that, you know, that ambition.
Robert, great to chat. Thanks a million.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.